Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs. We have a huge agenda, but we're going to go really fast, but we are not going to pass anything that the committee is not comfortable with. I would like to say that we are going to be carrying over to December 30th Senate Bill 587.
December?
Because we're waiting to see what happens.
You just said December 30th.
That works for me, Madam Chair.
Did you say Senate Gordon said December?
April 30th. We'll see, my birthday is then, and so it just comes out automatically.
Birthday party for the chair. I can deal with
that. We can handle
that. Yeah.
Okay, on April 30th, and then we do not have a fiscal yet on Senate Bill 353, and so that will be carried over to April 30th also. Okay, with that, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 958. We have the dash four amendments that made the changes, basically the fee change from the initial licensure of an in-home care agency to $1,500. Do you want to say anything else, Shannon? Do you want to come up or not?
This is the piece that was holding us up last time. The Dash 4 Amendment came back, which changes the initial licensure from $750 to $1,500, which I think pleases everybody.
Shortest testimony on record, Madam Chair. I'm Betsy Johnson from District 16. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Johnson. This is such an important piece of legislation.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 958 to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair, we need a motion on the amendment.
Oh, the dash?
Dash four.
Four amendment. Yes, let's do a slow down. Madam Chair, I move the dash four amendment to Senate Bill 958. Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Senator Gordley moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 958.
Madam Chair?
Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 958 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 958 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Johnson, would you please carry the bill?
Courtesy, Madam Chair, I would be delighted.
Okay, great. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 958, and I would like to open a work session on SJM 13.
Madam Chair, you ready? I move Senate Joint Memorial 13 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
There's one amendment to SJM 13, which brings information about the amount of money that Oregon would lose if Congress does not reissue the Children's Health Insurance Program.
And this was an amendment that we asked Jim Gardner to draft, to let them know that we really need that carryover money, and to bring that to their attention also.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm going to back up again and move the dash one amendment to SJM 13.
Okay, Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendments to SJM 13. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move SJM 13 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves SJM 13 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And please mark Senator Courtney as excused, and Senator Morissette will carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on SJM 13. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 364. And Shannon, bring us up to date on this.
Senate Bill 364 has a dash 2 amendment, which removes the provision which would allow council members to be reimbursed or provided compensation for their duties, which brings out the fiscal
And this goes to Ways and Means. If the committee so desires, is there any discussion?
And so are we. There's a dash two?
Yes, there's a dash two.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move.
Just a minute. Okay. When we have another task force for DHS, and Grant probably just stepped out, I assumed that it would still go to Ways and Means. So we are going to need to ask for a fiscal on this with the new amendment.
Madam Chair, I think we're.
Gina, you Nicholas. Will. Oh, you can speak to that. Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel, Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The reason that the dash twos were amended is that this now no longer needs a fiscal. This is already done by the department. This is just puts it in statute. And the amendments actually take away compensating the members, so there's no fiscal attached. That's why we redrafted this one.
I remember that.
Okay. Is the committee, and where is the agency on this?
They're fine with this, and Bob Nickel will be here in about
five minutes.
If you want to wait.
I'm sorry. Remember, before he left the last time, he said that he would support this.
Yes. All the fiscal is in the other bill, not in this one.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the SMS doesn't show a subsequent referral. Was there one on it?
No, there's not.
Okay,
not
then
now.
We don't need to rescind anything.
All right. All right, thank you.
Ready for a motion, Madam
Chair?
Yes,
and that, which amendments are we looking
at?
The dash twos, okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 364.
Senator Carter moves the dash twos to
Senator Gordley.
I'm trying to slow down. Senator Gordley moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 364. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 364 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Somebody making her work today.
I am. Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 364 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and this is another one of Senator Morissette's bills. So Senator Morissette will be the carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 364 and open a work session on Senate Bill 159. Shannon, bring us up to date on this one.
Senate Bill 159 specifies the maximum payment that non-contract emergency service providers must accept. There are two amendments, one that the Department of Human Services had drafted and one from some other folks, so you may want to call either the Hospital Association or the Department of Human Services up.
Okay, so would the Hospital Association, Kevin Earls, I see, and who's from the department? Yeah. Image, come forward.
What's your pleasure? Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Earls representing the Hospital Association. When the committee first considered Senate Bill 159, the discussion that we had was about the drafting of the bill, which brings the state in conformance with the Deficit Reduction Act, Federal Deficit Reduction Act, and that the language included in the bill was too broad, more broad than was necessary to bring the state in conformance. So we've developed amendments, the dash two amendments, which narrow the focus of the original draft specifically to language that accommodates the conformance with the Deficit Reduction Act and no more.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in DHS. Kevin just just spoke about a couple of concerns that came up when this bill was discussed quite a while back. I just had a chance late last night to see what the proposed amendments were. We still have a little bit of concern. One is that one of the concerns that had come up before was to make sure that this language in state statute would be the same as federal law in the Deficit Reduction Act, and we had suggested that the language as it was in the bill did not apply to both inpatient and outpatient services, and I don't see that that's been addressed in the amendments here, so that would still be a bit of concern of ours, and I don't know how you want to deal with that.
With that, I would like to just carry it over until April 30th to make sure that this is taken care of, if that's all right with you and with the committee.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Jim, the ones were yours?
Yes.
Okay. I don't see a conflict between the ones and twos, so we just need, I mean, they can both go as they stand, so, but we may need a three.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
All right, with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 159, and I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 587 we're carrying over. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 519. Shannon.
This Senate Bill 519 had several interested parties. I don't think they were ever able to convene a work group, but several people had amendments drafted. I think there's three currently. And so I know that someone from the Ellen Group and John Powell wanted to speak to this. You may want to see where they're at.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, the Dash 2 amendments are the ones that come from the amendment that we asked to be drafted. And what these amendments do is tie the services to covered services within the policy. The bill as printed could be read to cover services through telemedicine that were non-covered services in the policy. The Dash 2 amendments make it clear that the services provided by telemedicine also are covered by the insurance policy itself. So that's the main purpose of the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair and members, Chris Schultz representing Peace Health. We had drafted the Dash 3 amendments, which take care of two concerns. The bill is originally drafted.
Wait, just a minute.
Oh.
They were in a separate pile. They came at the end of the day yesterday.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
These amendments remove two provisions of the bill. One that says telemedicine is designed to serve only rural or underserved populations. We think if there are going to be state rules about telemedicine, they should apply more broadly. The second concern is that the bill is originally drafted only allowed telemedicine when a face-to-face visit wasn't possible within a reasonable distance. Reasonable distance is undefined. And again, if we're going to enter into a rulemaking process, we'd love to sort that out in the rulemaking process and not in the enabling legislation. I would also bring to your attention the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon has submitted written testimony, which I found in the box in the back of the room, but I don't know if anyone is here to speak to that, and their concerns mirror many of ours.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What have we heard from the sponsors of the bill about the amendments, both amendments, the twos and the threes?
It's my understanding that we had assigned the sponsor of the bill to coordinate a work group, and that did not happen. So if it is the will of this committee, I would like to have these amendments be discussed with the sponsor of the bill before we move forward.
I would agree with that.
I agree.
Particularly around the language focused on underserved and rural populations. As I recall, Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson was very explicit in his testimony about the need to be explicit in naming these populations. So I think we do need to delay.
And I would like to request then that we have a phone conference like we did before with Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson for Monday, April 30th. All right? Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the work session on 519. And staff, you have that we will be carrying this bill over. And committee, don't get concerned about me carrying these bills over, because I have scheduled, in case we can't cover all of the bills that morning, we have scheduled an evening for Monday night to make sure that we get all of these bills, and hopefully that doesn't run into problems of it's midnight, or is it 5 o'clock that we were supposed to have everything done?
Midnight. But please, I beg you, because it's starting to happen, you know. I know I'm so easy and I'm a cream puff, but please, don't test me. Don't ask me, please.
Okay, just so long as I know that if we have our committee from 5:15 to 6, that these bills would be able to be covered or carried to the floor or Ways and Means. Okay. All right, with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 519, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 939. And at this point, there was... yes, Mr. DeLashment, if you would bring us up to date on where the county is and where you are. And
for the record, Brian DeLashment, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. As you recall, you heard this in one of your evening presentations. It had been mislabeled as a work session, and you had not had a public hearing on it, so now you have a public hearing on it. I am not aware of the county's position. I know that they did come forward and say they had some concerns about it as far as an unfunded mandate. We acknowledge that, and if you recall, during that discussion, all we wanted to do is move this bill down to Ways and Means so it could be a part of a broader discussion about community corrections, community health care, and public health. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Madam Chair, that seemed to be a reasonable thing with me since they are discussing it. And I know Chip Shields is looking at the broad implications of what's happening in the prison system, so I think that's appropriate. And when you go into a work session, I'm sure to give you a motion.
All right. Thank you.
With that,
any other discussion? I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 939, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 939. Senator Carter?
Then Chair, yes, would refer Senate Bill 939 to the full Committee of Ways and Means of the Legislature.
I didn't hear the last piece of what you said.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 939 to the full Committee of Ways and Means.
Thank you. So we move, Senator Carter would like to move Senate Bill 939 to the full Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yes. I'd like to be recorded as a no, quite simply because I do have concerns about the implications at the local level, and I know that discussion will go on, but just be recorded because there are concerns, especially with some of our rural counties that are potentially losing the ability to even have a jail. So it's a very big and very real concern, and so from that perspective, I will be a no on the bill at this point.
Thank you, Senator Cruz, and it is true that funding is truly in a crisis in many of our counties, but I would also like to point out that the health care process and system in the counties is extremely important, and it may cost us more money in the long run if we do not provide an adequate health care plan within our local jail systems.
Madam Chair, I understand the intent and I understand the scope and the need, but you know, we don't even know at this point in time whether the safety net will be reauthorized, and but if it is, it's diminishing over time. So, mm-hmm. And you know, I want to thank the president once again for the tour of the rural counties last weekend, and because this is an issue that, I mean, we're going to have to pay a lot more attention in the future to the nexus between state services and county services as we move forward in time.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Appreciate that. And you know that this committee has had a lot of discussion about the mental health issues and the mental health issues in the correction system. That's all part of the health care plan. And so we at least need to start the discussion. There needs to be funding for it. We don't appear to have the funding for it, but we cannot. It would be my preference if we would move that. Is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Gorley?
Aye.
Chair Monica.
Aye. Motion carries. I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 939. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Shannon, will you bring us up to date on this one?
Yeah, Senate Bill 153 requires employee benefit plan and health insurer to reimburse the state Medicaid expenditures. It's another DHS bill that brings us into line with the Deficit Reduction Act, and there's someone from the department to just speak briefly to the amendment as well as the bill.
Okay. Is there any opposition? Good morning, Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee. My name for the record is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator of the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery with the Department of Human Services. I spoke with you about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago regarding this bill. At that point, we did not have the amendments. As Shannon stated, this bill brings us in alignment with the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. Simply stated, it requires that health insurers and employee benefit plans share information with the department regarding the benefits that they are covering. We often run into issues where insurance companies are reluctant to share information. The Deficit Reduction Act and this bill will help us so that we can get that information regarding third parties that are liable for payment prior to Medicaid paying the claim. This bill also puts into law some time frames for which those Medicaid claims must be honored in the situation where Medicaid pays and then we have to do a third-party recovery after the fact. This puts in time frames for honoring those claims and time frames in which we need to file those claims. The amendments simply clarify the parties that are defined in health insurers. This information came to the department after the bill was initially drafted, therefore causing us to need to amend the bill to include some additional language that CMS provided later. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Where are the insurers on this? Is anyone in the audience? Okay.
Chair Monica Anderson, we did work with the Department of Consumer and Business Services prior to session, put information out about this bill, including the portions of the Deficit Reduction Act. We only had one question from an insurer based on that sharing of information, and we were able to answer that question, so I think they're fine with it. Most insurers currently are willing to share this information with us. This just puts into law what the federal government is requiring us to do.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Yes.
Which insurer, and what was the question?
Let me look in my notes here. Excuse me for just a moment.
No problem.
You know, rather, Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Gordley, rather than dig through my paperwork here, I know I have a little note in this file somewhere. What I recall is it was a very small insurer, and the question was, how was the definition, did the definition include them as an insurer? So the answer was, to the extent that they provide health insurance, yes, it does. The insurer was mainly a liability insurer, and that's why they wondered what the impact to them was. And to the extent that they provide health insurance benefits or pay for Medicaid or medical costs as a result of maybe an accident that occurred, they would be responsible to report to us. I can get you that name and the exact question. I'd be happy to do that. It's in here somewhere.
Yeah, just to flesh out the record. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
And I do want to say this. I had an accident about 2 years ago at Costco, and Costco could have paid me money without paying Medicaid their portion if they wanted to have it. Then, if not, then Medicaid have to go back if the insurance company don't give them information. And then when we talk about the recovery program in DHS, Senator Gordley, that's one of the complications that you have, that it's hard to get it once the people have gotten it in their hands. And if they owe Medicaid, Medicaid should be able to have that money based upon their ability to talk with the insurers mm-hmm. about the person, how much money it is, and so they can be recovered.
Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion? I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 153, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 153.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 153.
Senator Gordley moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 153. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 153 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, would you?
Okay.
Carry this.
It should be worth something.
All right. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 153. I think I already did that. And
let's double close then.
Yes, double close. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 4. Bring us up to date on Senate Bill 4.
Senate Bill 4 is the nursing shortage bill. Declares the nursing workforce shortage, includes increasing nursing workforce as a goal of Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee. There are at least 4 amendments as of yesterday afternoon. I don't know if there's any more, but you should have at least -1 through 4 in your packets.
Okay. Kristen Leonard, Chris Campbell, and Susan King, if you would go through the amendments with us, that would be most helpful.
Jonathan Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Kristen Leonard here representing the Oregon Center for Nursing, and we'd like to talk about briefly the -4 amendments. And these are the amendments that we have brought forward after some, I would say, work with various interested parties and trying to find policy language that met some concerns. So we'll briefly go through the -4 amendments. And then I wanted to let you know that we also have Chris Campbell, the executive director for the Oregon Center for Nursing, and Susan King, who is on the board of the Center for Nursing, here to answer any additional questions you may have. So we'll quickly go through the -4 amendments, if that's all right. First, basically the beginning of the -4 amendments are just outlining or declaring an official shortage of nurses, and we've added nurse faculty in Oregon, just making the declaration that this is a workforce issue in Oregon. First page, lines about 3 through 8 is a description of OHSU as the fiscal agent as it relates to any administrative expenses in dealing with the grants and the distribution of some of these monies that we've requested and will be talked about hopefully in Ways and Means. Lines 9 through approximately 20.
Okay, just a minute. Delete post-secondary ed. So who are you distributing the grants to then?
It was basically clarifying language to as it relates to the various places that these grants could be distributed. And so removing current language that talks about that it's post-secondary education institutions to support nursing education programs, and basically just leaving kind of a more broad field by which these grants could be distributed to various programs within the state.
And then the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee, is that the same as the Oregon Center for Nursing?
Do you want to touch on that?
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, the Shortage Coalition Committee is a committee that was established through Senate Bill 800 in 2003, I believe. And it
Oh, identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. After all these years, Susan King from Oregon Center for Nursing. That committee was established in law through Senate Bill 800, which you worked on in 2003. So it is a legislatively authorized oversight committee that would determine where grants would go. And the reason that we eliminated post-secondary institutions was, at the time Senate Bill 800 passed, it was dealing only with nursing education. If this bill passes and is ultimately funded, we would anticipate that individuals, for example, who wish to be nursing faculty members could receive a stipend or assistance with scholarships or something like that. So we had to remove the restrictive language that would direct it only to the educational program so that we could be more broad in our application of the funds.
So the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee is in statute, and the Center for Oregon Nurses is not?
Correct.
And so is this the same thing? Who makes up the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee?
We will actually, if you turn to the amendments, let me make sure I get them, page 2, the amendments where it starts with, starting at line 13, section 9 is the current statutory language as it relates to this Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee.
So are we the 4-1s or 4-2?
The dash 4.
We're looking at dash 4s.
But I just need to understand that the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee, I just need to have on record who are the members of that.
So the members are, it's a 10-member board, 2 members who represent the Oregon State Board of Nursing, 2 members who represent the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives.
And those are, nurse executives are who?
Nurse executives from various providers throughout the Northwest. So it's those providers interested in the nursing shortage.
Right, from the hospitals and healthcare systems.
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Chris Campbell from the Oregon Center for Nursing.
And they are nurse executives from the hospitals?
For the hospitals and health systems, that's correct.
And health systems. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's see. 2 representatives from the Oregon Nurses Association. 1 member from the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and we have...
I thought you already said there was 2 from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Okay, who represents the Oregon Council of Dean... Wait a minute. Sorry, I lost track. So we've got... So we've got someone from the State Board of Nursing who represents a nursing program... within an institution, so an non-profit, or someone from the Oregon Council of Deans. So the intention really is to have someone who is representing one of the education programs in Oregon, nursing programs.
And would that be the people from the community colleges?
No, they have their own seat. This would be from the Oregon Council of Deans, and that is an organization of the deans of the baccalaureate and higher programs of nursing in Oregon.
Great. Thank you.
So then, Chair Mona Sanderson, if you move to page 3 of the dash 4 amendments, you will see that there's also 2 members from the community colleges.
Great.
And then...
What line?
So page 3, lines 1 through 6, define the community college role on
in section 9, it's It states who is on the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition. And then...
Madam Chair, I'm curious about the amendments that they're proposing. For example, there are two members appointed by the Commissioner for Community College Services, and currently it's from a list submitted to the Commissioner by the Community College Association, and now it's no longer the Community College Association. I find that curious.
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz, this language was attempting to say that there has to be an appointing body that's officially designated by the legislature. So that would be the Commissioner for Community College Services. However, since this is a nursing workforce bill, and since the Center for Nursing and the nursing leadership group that has brought this bill forward includes OCAP, which is the Oregon Council of Associate Degree Programs, or the nursing programs, we wanted to make it symmetrical with the rest of the way the bill is described. So, for example, ONA is a private organization. We can't appoint anyone, but we submit our names to the Board of Nursing for appointment. In this way, the Community College Associate Degree Nursing Faculty Organization, which is the professional association for those faculty, would be recommending the names to the commissioner, one of whom would be someone that is from the Community College Association, and one of whom has to be a nurse, since this is a nursing workforce bill. But if you see the rest of the appointment mechanisms throughout the rest of the amendments, it is the private organization that represents that nursing group that makes the recommendations, with an official body ultimately doing the appointment.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I feel very comfortable with the people that they have here, because it represents the associations from the baccalaureate as well as the associate degree people and the different councils. The one question I do have, because I think there are resources available that could serve you well, and that is from the workforce development people. Now, I do think, because the governor has a broad strategy on trying to help with the nursing shortage, that a workforce development person who is helping with that strategy should be considered because of resources that they have available. And I think that's the one I am concerned about.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Carter, I think your point is well taken. And if you, as we go through the rest of the amendments, our amendment to Section 6 actually does link this to the workforce development work. And so that was our intention to do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
I would like to understand the role of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association.
Gone.
That language is removed on line 29 of page 2. Is there a defined role for the Oregon Independent Colleges Association that we should understand that's not identified in the amendment?
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Gordley. What we were attempting to do in that item, item D, was to make it symmetrical with other appointments. As you see in the on page 3 of the amendments in item F, OHSU, which is the only state or public baccalaureate program currently in Oregon, has a representative. So item D, again, allows the Council of Deans, which are the deans of baccalaureate programs, to recommend to the Oregon State Board of Nursing someone who represents their interests. So the Council of Deans would include the dean at OHSU, but OHSU is already named as a member of this committee. So the Council of Deans is now free to recommend one additional person who presumably, we can't speak for them, but presumably would be from the independent colleges that have baccalaureate programs. So it's just attempting to make this language symmetrical throughout the amendment. It's the private organization of the nurses who recommends to either the Oregon State Board of Nursing or another entity.
let's see, the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, does that organization participate on the Oregon Council of Deans? I'm still trying to think they do.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Gordley, the Council of Deans is involved with the Independent Colleges Association. For example, Concordia University, University of Portland, and all of those deans would be involved with the Independent Colleges Association, but they are specifically deans of nursing programs and therefore presumably more knowledgeable about specific nursing workforce, but they are a part of the Independent Colleges. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that that's part of the record too, because OHSU is explicitly identified in the amendments.
And
but we're not explicitly identifying any other institution that is independent, and I just wanted to clarify that point. Thank you.
So where does Linfield fall under this?
Linfield is a private, independent baccalaureate program, so it would fall within this other group of baccalaureate programs that would have option to have a seat on this shortage coalition committee.
But under which criteria?
It would be under item D on page two of the amendments.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It would be Linfield, University of Portland, Concordia. George Fox.
And so then, Madam Chair, is Linfield also a part of that Oregon Council of Deans?
Yes.
As
yes.
Well? Okay. All right.
Concordia and George Fox, have they participated up to now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yes, Senator.
A couple questions. One, while we're on this, currently, is the committee not working well?
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz, I'm the only one here who's actually on the committee. We met initially, but the legislature, due to a variety of circumstances, not the least of which was the recession, failed to fund Senate Bill 800. So although it's nice to see everybody on the committee, we didn't have any money to spend, so we haven't met for a number of years, actually.
Okay, so we're changing the makeup based on
the group that exists.
Yeah, but not based on the fact that the current makeup doesn't work. But, Madam Chair, getting back to page one of the amendment and the bill, section two, lines 9 and 10, where we're eliminating post-secondary education institutions to support nursing education programs. And you stated that it was so you could give stipends to people who are teaching nursing, and I'm wondering how that would work. I mean, because most people who are teaching nursing are on the payroll of whatever institution they're teaching in. Mm-hmm. And so are you looking at doing something outside of the existing salary structure? I mean, I would assume that monies going to these institutions could be used as well for increasing funding, increasing the pay schedule, as well as other needs for the program. So you're looking at doing something outside of that defined structure?
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz, the example I used was one particular criteria that we may want to look at, assuming this bill passes. The reason that we eliminated the language is that Senate Bill 800 from 2003 specifically focused on education. This bill is focused on nursing workforce more broadly. So the grants that we would like to be able to offer based on this bill would be not only that kind of stipend, and I'll come back to explaining what I mean, because I'm sure you would have a question about someone who's already on salary, but it also would be to fund initiatives around retention, for example, retention of nurses, and there are some pieces of this bill that speak directly to retention of nurses in the workforce. But specifically with respect to the stipend issue, there may well be qualified individuals who, for example, are working in a hospital,
who could be qualified to be a faculty, but in order for them to leave their salaried position in a hospital and seek to become to obtain the degrees, the graduate degrees necessary to become a faculty, it would be cost prohibitive. So, for example, one of the things that we could fund if this bill passes is we could fund a stipend for that nurse to go through graduate school and then ultimately become a nursing faculty. So it would not be something that would be just offered over and above the salary of a community college faculty member or a baccalaureate faculty member, but that might be an option as well. That, of course, would need to be worked out if they're part of a collective bargaining agreement or a salary structure within a facility. But we're really looking at how can we assist individuals to become faculty who are qualified to do so.
Okay. I guess, Madam Chair, going to kind of direct to the point on this thing, we've recognized the shortage for a long time, but I've also recognized the fact that most of our teaching facilities have wait lists of people trying to get into the program, and first and foremost priority for me would be ramping up those programs, which would be increasing the number of teachers as well as compensating them at a reasonable level, but also recognizing from the perspective of a community college, for example, how salary needs to fit into the structure inside that institution as well. So that was my concern with this elimination.
Mm-hmm. Lynn. Yes. The comprehensive nature of this bill is entertaining the notion that all the students that are in the pipeline waiting to come into program, you still have to have sufficient nursing faculty mm-hmm. to be able to do it. So that's why it's a comprehensive approach, and that is dealing with the issue not only of trying to deal with the nursing shortage, but dealing with retention, dealing with faculty. How many faculty are proposed to be retiring this year?
Within the next 2 years, I believe it's 36. The projections or the needs are, actually I have those numbers specifically. What I do know is that according to the State Board of Nursing, within the next 3 to 5 years, up to 5 years, we're going to need 92 additional faculty.
Absolutely, we heard that.
And not additional, those are replacement faculty as well as for the program expansion that is expected.
Exactly.
And our faculty at the baccalaureate level need a doctorate, so that there's a long pipeline to get that education. And this faculty, the request that we have for monies for faculty are to build those master's and doctorally prepared faculty in any way we can help them get through the program,
right,
whether it's scholarship, stipends, or support for the programs that they're going to.
Madam Chair, I really do like the approach that is taken here, and I have been looking at this for a long time, and when you look at a more comprehensive approach to this, I really do think that it's doing what we wanted to do. And I think with them tying in the workforce development people and looking at private independent associations as well as private schools, I think that they have a real broad net here by which we're going to feel very comfortable in the future that we have a comprehensive approach to looking at this issue. And I would certainly support the progression of this bill, providing there is a money source in place for it. And if that's the reason we're asking the question, I just believe in getting down to the horse's mouth. How much does this program cost? And I know you don't like me to ask weighted means questions.
I think good for us to know.
Right now the request in Senate Bill 4 is $3.7 million, and that's for comprehensive kind of several different programs, making sure that these monies are available for the Nursing Shortage Grant Fund, also funding the work that's been done by the Oregon Center for Nursing for the last several years. And there's also a $500,000 addition, if you will, to scholarship monies within OSAC for.
So have you identified money sources for this bill?
Not at this point in time, no.
Okay. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. what I would like to propose is that this group have further conversation with the chair, Ways and Means, and that what you could do is hold this bill over until you have some direction from the Ways and Means person, because it really is a comprehensive bill, and we can beat it to death. But if we're going to progress it, then it should be done with the cooperation of the leadership, and especially the leadership of Ways and Means.
Thank you. Before we go down that route, I need some clarification on the members of the committee yet, and I know that on OHSU, well, first of all, I need to ask, are the deans always RNs that represent the nurse, the, well, is everyone so far only a nurse? I need to know if the
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, the only non-nurse, as I'm looking at my papers here, the only non-nurse is on page 3 of the amendments in item E, and that would be one representative from the of the Commissioner on Community College Services. And being the historian, I guess, on of the three of us, in 2003, when we passed Senate Bill 800, in order to get agreement for that bill, the Community College Association felt it important that there be someone on this committee that was not necessarily from the nursing faculty, and that was a compromise we made in 2003. It could be that the Commissioner for Community College appoints two nurses, but the option was left open that at least one needs to be a nursing faculty from a community college nursing program, and one could be someone else appointed by the commissioner. It could be someone with workforce expertise, as Senator Carter identifies, or it could be a nursing faculty member. But that was an agreement we made a number of years ago.
Because I know when we worked with OHSU, it was extremely beneficial to have Dr. Lindsay, the woman, her name slips my mind, from OHSU.
Leslie Halleck? Dr. Halleck from the provost.
Dr. Leslie Halleck. So she has always represented OHSU at this point in time, but now that's changed to a registered nurse and a member of the faculty of the School of Nursing. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to have OHSU's input, and I'm not sure anyone from OHSU is here. Go ahead.
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, members were actually discussed within our leadership group on which OHSU has a membership. So this represents at least the current thinking as of today of the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council, which is sort of the broader group behind the Center for Nursing. And I don't think that there would be any interest, assuming this bill passes and we actually are able to fund grants, for us to seek advice from all of those individuals who can provide it for us. Mm-hmm. And that would include other people within the university systems and workforce systems. So I don't think there would be an exclusion of other advisory roles for other people, but rather we're trying to focus the best expertise we can on the problem of the nursing workforce.
Okay. Moving on to the...
Yeah, Chair Mona Sanderson, if we can, I will continue through the dash fours. I'm aware of our time constraints here. But make sure I start where I left off. So page one of the dash four amendments, starting from line 9 to line 20. Basically, what I would characterize this as the charges and goals for the Oregon Nursing Shortage Committee, kind of outlining those elements and criteria by which this committee should look at how they disperse funds, and the different goals, if you will, of the committee. And that's section 3 in the actual bill. So starting on line 21, page 1 through line 6 on page 2, this basically outlines some of the ways an education institution may use grant money. So just outlining some of the important elements. We've added developing nursing curriculum, as well as increasing diversity in nursing, which is one of the goals of the Center for Nursing and the mission of the organization. Section 6 on page 2, this is an important piece to talk about, and we want to touch upon. We have some concerns about the drafting in the Dash 4s, and we have a request in for some changes. And so there hopefully will be a set of Dash 5s very soon that make the following changes, if you will, to Section 6. And this really outlines the mission of the Oregon Center for Nursing is how we hope this reads. So the Oregon Center for Nursing shall serve in an advisory role to the State Workforce Institute Investment Board, and we would like to cross off any and just have and other entities involved with nursing workforce development. Again, the goal is really to look at the work of the Center for Nursing and all the research and everything that's been done as appropriate in advising the Workforce Investment Board on issues as it relates to nursing and the nursing shortage. So that is Section 6, and that's the request we have in the council right now for changes. On page 2, lines 10 through 12, this deals with language in the bill relating to the PERS 1039 rule. Really, the mission of this piece of legislation is to look at how can we attract and retain nurses and nursing faculty at all levels of their career. And so we've looked at everything from scholarships and those entering the career to those at the, I would say, closer to the end of their career. And so we're also looking at ways that we can take advantage of those retired nurses who can come back and serve some additional time working within the profession. So this just makes nurses and nurse faculty an exception to the PERS 1039 rule. Let's see.
We have another bill that's supposed to move out of committee, too, that would address this issue.
Yes, and we're very aware of that bill. We've been monitoring it and feeling like it would probably be easier to strip our language out at some point in time than try to add it back in. So,
okay.
We spent some time on page 2 talking about Section 9 and the makeup of the committee. So if it's okay, I would like to skip to page 4 in the amendment and talk about lines 9 through 17, which this really is what I would characterize as the description of the appropriation and of monies and who serves as the fiscal agent. So OHSU is the fiscal agent for the Center for Nursing. This is page 5 in the actual bill, and it outlines the various appropriations in those
What line
agencies.
Is that? Line 16?
I'm sorry, Chairman Sanderson, on the Dash 4s or the...
Yeah, but it's on the original bill. It would be line 5, page 5.
Page 5, line 10, excuse me, 10 through 19.
And OHSU, okay.
And, Madam Chair?
Yes.
If you could say again, if I missed it earlier, you're deleting Portland State University and inserting OHSU. And the what's happening there with the two institutions?
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Gordley, it was a drafting error.
Okay.
Portland State has never been involved in this, and so okay. I think they just inserted which university.
And when Senate Bill 800 was set up, it was always OHSU since they have the capacity to do this.
Yeah. Okay. All right, what I would like, we'll wait for amendments. I'd like to carry this over and to April 30th. I would like to have input from OHSU and Dr. Halleck, who had been very involved. Just, I want OHSU to know about these amendments. Who else can you share since the amendments just came out? I know the hospitals, to me, just seem like a logical source of funding for an for a center like this, since
since nursing shortage is so critical to there, has any work been done in trying to set up a business plan with the hospitals at all?
We've had, the hospitals and health systems have supported our work. We've had donations. A major funder has been the Kaiser Permanente, and we've done golf tournaments also, as you know, and they've the hospitals and health systems have supported that. But we have not talked to them about funding the center on an ongoing basis. It's been by donation and support of the programs that we have and the fundraising events that we've had. They've also supported our leadership development initiative, but it's been by program primarily and by donation. It's not been a funding source. That is a way some centers for nursing are funded.
That's right, in other parts of the United States. So that's why I'm thinking we're so critically short that I would hope that at some point that we could look at other sources of funding and bringing the hospitals in seems like a very logical thing to do.
Senator Mona Sanderson, I think you raise an interesting question, and as Chris has said, we've enjoyed the support of many organizations. I do think we should note that Providence Health System, for example, has invested millions of dollars in what's called the Providence Scholars Program through the University of Portland, and they are actually funding students in their last 2 years of their university education. With the only requirement then that those students stay with them in the system for 3 years of practice. So I think there are many places where the hospitals are already investing in Lane County. My understanding is that the hospitals there are investing in faculty and student positions at Lane Community College. So I think that they really already do deserve credit for the amount of money that they are pouring into their specific local program, and that's very much appreciated. It has allowed us to increase, make the 45%, approximate 45% increase in graduates over the last 5 years because of these investments that hospitals have already made.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I would suggest, since there's going to be further amendments coming forward, that community colleges also be consulted on the draft language, since how a whole lot of nursing training happens at that level.
So would you contact the either, I'll direct Shannon and Chris. Kristen or Susan or Chris, either one of you, contact that. And also, I'd like Lita just to come up a little bit because you represent the workforce Governor's Workforce Shortage Coalition. I know that it's not in the governor's budget, but I know that you had been working with these folks, and just brief comments.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson. For the record, I'm Lita Colligan, Governor's Workforce Policy Advisor, and I did not come prepared today to testify. I'm sorry.
You could look at the dash fours at some point and then be willing to, on April 30th, to give us your reaction also
sure.
to this, because I know you've been working.
I'd be happy to do that. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Is there any other questions? Thank you. Thank you. And hopefully we'll have the also Dr. OHSU, Dr. Halleck. I want her to have the dash four.
She's the provost.
The provost, yes.
There's the dean, and then there's the provost, yeah. So I guess.
And the dean. I'm not sure who the appropriate.
The acting dean right now is Dr. Judith Bates, because Dr. Sandy Tice is out.
Okay, so Dean Bates, is she an RN?
Yes, she's the
RN.
Gotcha.
Okay.
And she has the amendments. Okay.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 4, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 717. Do you want to bring us up to date? 717.
Senate Bill 717 is the Scope of Practice Review Committee bill. Would require the Board of Medical Examiners to appoint a Scope of Practice Review Committee, and there are three amendments, which you should find in your packet.
Okay. The dash ones, just as a review, the original bill has the Board of Medical Examiners appoint a Scope of Practice Review Committee. And anyone who wanted to change their scope of practice would need to put the change before the Board of Medical Examiners, and Board of Medical Examiners would convene a work group, and then the work group would make recommendations. What the dash ones do, and there was a work group that convened, and there were a number of recommendations, and I'd like to bring Nan Heim up, and who else on the... Claudia Black, and but there was definitely concern that the Board of Medical Examiners maybe would have too much power in all of this. So the dash ones were written to make sure that the Board of Medical Examiners would just be a convener. They wouldn't appoint the neutral parties. The opponents and proponents would do that, and also we changed it so that they wouldn't, the committee report would not be taken to the Board of Medical Examiners. The recommendation would strictly come from the committee, and then it would be forwarded to the legislature. We also added in the dash ones that we listed a number of criteria that must be used when coming up with scope of practice changes, and we wanted to add that the evidence-based information should be used, provided by the Center for Evidence-Based Policy of the Oregon Health and Sciences University. So the dash ones keeps it under the Board of Medical Examiners convening the group. The dash twos changes the Board of Medical Examiners and has the Center for Evidence-Based Policy of the Oregon Health and Science University do that, and everything else is with the changes that we made in one. The only change in the dash twos from the dash ones is we would add the Center for Evidence-Based Policy of OHSU to be the convener. And then the dash threes is exactly like the dash ones also, except instead of the Board of Medical Examiners, they would insert, we would have the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. So that explains the three amendments. But I would like Nan to give a summary of what happened at the work group. And
Madam Chair, members.
Bill Donovan, please. You can come up another opposition.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before you get into the testimony, the dash ones also delete the Board of Medical Examiners. And insert.
Oh, that's only on the appointment. The Board of Medical Examiners still will be the convener, but if you look at the main bill, it has a Board of Medical Examiners who appoint, who do the appointments, and we want the proponents and the opponents to appoint the members of the committees, not the Board of Examiners. So that's what, it doesn't remove the Board of Medical
right.
Examiners okay. for convening it.
Okay.
It just removes that piece where they would be appointing the members.
Okay.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. The work group basically agreed on several things and didn't agree on one thing. What they agreed on was to add that the committees would consider evidence-based information provided by the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, and they agreed, the work group agreed to take out the requirement that the Board of Medical Examiners submit a recommendation to the legislature, and they agreed to a sunset, that this was something that would be tried and then sunsetted. So those are the three things that the work group basically agreed to. What they did not agree to was who should be the convener. And as you know, all three amendments basically make whoever is the convener just a convener. There's no recommendation, there's no oversight other than providing staff support. So that kind of summarizes where the work group is. And the Board of Medical Examiners, and just for the record, did not seek this legislation, as you know. But they now, and initially I have to say they were a little bit nervous about it, but they have discussed it at some length and support it, and they're certainly ready to do it if you decide to proceed. And we hope that the change, that the board does not make a recommendation, nor would it any longer appoint the neutral members. We hope that that would allay some of the concerns that others have. The board is still from time to time requested for their position on scope of practice changes when it involves something that's under the Medical Practices Act that they are charged with enforcing. And I think that this process will give them an opportunity to make an informed recommendation when they are asked.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association. I appreciate the opportunity to address this issue today. We testified earlier that we thought an interim work group might be the best solution to this problem, and we've since reconsidered our position, and we now support the -1 amendments. We participated in the work group that Ms. Heim mentioned last week and discussed the various options and considered possible amendments. The OMA supports the BME as the convener for the Scope of Practice Review Committee, and we believe that the amendments that have been put forward in the -1 should alleviate a number of the other parties' concerns, those that were mentioned both by yourself and Ms. Heim, allowing the proponents and opponents to jointly pick the neutral parties, forwarding the information that they're the report from the review committee without recommendation to the legislature, and sunsetting the process in 4 years. We also believe that including the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU is an important component. So we fully support the -1 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to opposition, I would like the -3s have the Oregon policy, Oregon health policy, Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, and I'd like to have Dr. Smith come up to at least address the -3 amendments, because I know that was something that some of the opponents said, well, let's have it in the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. And so I think we need to get Dr. Smith, who heads up that organization, her input.
Do we also have, Madam Chair, someone from the Center for Evidence-Based Policy?
Is someone from Mark Gibson here? They're in the middle of transition, and maybe you can address what you had shared with me. They are in the midst of transition. They are not interested in being a convener at this point in time, but they are in transition with directors, et cetera, so they're not interested, but this was a recommendation that came out of the committee work group, and so that's why I had those amendments drafted too, just in case we could get more input from the Office for Evidence-Based.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I was not a member of the work group specifically, but did have discussions with some of the members of the work group and Chair Mona Sanderson about this last week. I also did speak with Mark Gibson last week at the Center for Evidence-Based Policy. And looking at the Office of Health Policy and what we do with our commissions and committee, I'd say that this that the -3s really do fall outside of our scope of practice. It would really be a stretch for any of our current existing commissions
commissions and committees to do this as we look at more coverage decisions and policy design. I think that the expertise in the boards, licensing boards, is really what you want. I think they would have a better background on this than we would. We also have to defer to the OHSU Center for Disease Policy.
Who would have a better background?
I would think the Board of Medical Examiners or some of the other licensing boards would be better suited for this. I think it's an intriguing idea, though. I think it's an excellent idea on trying to get the evidence and the pros and cons collected for you all to make your policy decisions. We turn to the office, to OHSU, for our detailed literature reviews when we do reviews of pharmaceutical products and medical technology assessments. I think also close collaboration with the Patient Safety Commission is important. I did look a little bit around to see what other states were doing, and most of this is done in via licensing boards in other states. I looked at the state of Maine has, and I shared this with Mona Anderson, I only have one additional copy and I can leave this with the committee, but Maine had a large grant from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation where they tried to sort of consolidate all these regulatory actions into one sort of congealed process. And just looking at some of the reports that they now give to the legislature, it basically, essentially, in 25 pages, tells you, you know, here's the pros, here's the cons, and here's the evidence. And I think that's what you're looking for. And I think that this is a, overall, via however you want to situate it, I think the concept is excellent and really gets us. And as we look at broader health reform, I think looking at how to make these decisions, because delivery of health care might mean some adjustments on how we traditionally do things, and best looking at the evidence is what that means for patient safety, public health. I think this is a good step. I'm just not sure that the Office of Health Policy is the best place to put it for the convening part.
Questions?
Yes, Madam
yes.
Chair.
Senator.
So in the Maine experience, what is the convening authority in Maine?
As far as I could find, this report was old and was not available online, and so we have to send away for it. So I don't have the full report, but they have an Office of Professional and Financial Regulation that kind of oversees a large percentage of their regulatory bodies and they all have certain criteria and evidence that they set up similar to what you have outlined in the bill as to what would be the impact on public health and what would be the impact on patient safety. So this is not my expertise. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at this, but I think that that's something that would be good to continue to look at, is how to better shape. We've got something in DAS that does a little bit of regulation on cosmetologists and athletic boards. We've got some health regulation over in public health, and then we've got the boards. You know, as we look at broader utopia of healthcare, maybe there's some way to pull this all together in the future. But I think this is a nice first step to see how this works.
And we did look at setting up an entirely new entity, but that would have been a huge fiscal and growing government. So we were looking at an entity that already dealt with scope of practice. And so that's why these three came to mind. And now we know why the dash threes probably aren't a good source.
Did we look at the existing health licensing agency or health licensing board?
Senator Mona Anderson and Senator Gourley, I wasn't part of the work group, so I'm not sure what all they looked at. I've only just sort of jumped in the last few days. So
that's right, you did say that. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, that was an initial discussion, mm-hmm. and the issue, if you'll notice, proposing a change to the scope of practice of a healthcare profession that may fall under the scope of what constitutes the practice of medicine under ORS 677.085, and that is the Medical Practices Act. And so that's what this bill is designed to address, mm-hmm. a scope of practice change that falls under the Medical Practices Act, and that's why the Board of Medical Examiners seem to be the logical place to try this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they would just be the convener under the dash ones.
And I want to, for the record, oh, yes, Senator Carter, go ahead.
To you,
okay. I We have a letter from Mark Gibson, the Deputy Director for the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU, and wanted to put on the record that he is definitely willing to have the center be helpful in any way possible. And he goes on and explains what the center has done, but then he says, I have concerns about the Dash 2 amendments that place the center for responsibility for appointing a scope of practice review committee. While the center has demonstrated its ability to help diverse interests agree on principles for guiding deliberations, that he thinks the center is ill-equipped to be the appointing authority for it. And so that there's also the agency that really feels that his agency is not the appropriate place for this. So that takes care of the Dash 2s. All right. Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, some things just make so much common sense, and I was just wondering why, if the Medical Practices Act is being carried, oversaw and carried out through the Board of Medical Examiners, why it appears, and I don't blame all these other groups for saying no to this, because you have a regulatory agency, and if you ask this regulatory agency who already has dollars in its hoppers to be able to do some of this stuff, or if you have to give a small amount more money, you're not growing government, and you have all of these medical professionals already on the board. I just don't see why we want to go outside of that agency to try to do something else. I don't understand it. And I don't care if the medical association or who else in hell has come here, then dismantle the Board of Medical Examiners if we don't want them, and put something else in its place to do something that deals with the Medical Practices Act. It doesn't make sense at all to me. You have them here, and if you want to be real clear about what you want them to do in looking at scope of practice, then be real clear about that and let them bring some other medical people in, or some people that you can entrust to look at this issue in a fair kind of way, and let them be the agency that facilitates this stuff. It doesn't make sense to me for all this long, drawn-out conversation okay. around all these other groups.
With that, I would like to have Phil Donovan, the sole opponent of this bill that's coming forward anyway.
Thank you, Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for that warm introduction. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and try as we might, we cannot get to a position of support for Senate Bill 717. And I just want to articulate two levels of concern. First off, on a practical level, our concern is that we're creating a new barrier to scope of practice issues. And since flattery gets you further than criticism, and there are six of you and only one of me, let me just go out and say that, you know, the legislature does a very good job on these issues. Gosh darn it, we've got some pretty good legislators in this state. And because of this legislature, Oregon's naturopathic laws are some of the best in the country. We're held up as leaders. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that there are a lot of issues, scope of practice issues, legislation that comes to this body every legislative session. But at the same time, we found that the checks and balances work reasonably well. On a more philosophical level, it can be argued that legislators don't have the biases that you find within the different medical disciplines. So charging the Board of Medical Examiners, or OHSU, you know, that has its roots in conventional medicine, inherently creates a bias. And there is a disconnect from profession to profession. In many cases, a fundamental lack of understanding of the philosophy, the techniques, and the materials that are used. In the best case scenario, we have many medical doctors who are very open to naturopathic medicine. And even they don't often fully understand the training, the level of training and expertise that naturopathic doctors have. And at worst, they're totally opposed. And therefore, you're setting up a process where you've got proponents and opponents, and you're supposed to arrive at consensus, and that may not occur very easily. Finally, I want to point out that some jump at the answers of proffered evidence-based studies. One of the concerns that we have is that the questions, which are usually grounded in conventional medicine, are not necessarily the questions that would be asked for naturopathic medicine. So I'm going to close with this. because of the great differences in philosophy, medical philosophy, that is, we do believe that the individual disciplines and their boards, and Ann Walsh from the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners was a part of the work group process, we believe they're best suited to consider scope of practice issues and then bring to this legislative body. And then for the record, we believe that the Office of Health Policy and Research is less inherently biased than the other options, even though it sounds like they've taken themselves out of the picture on the dash threes. So.
Okay.
Anyways, with that, I'll close. I appreciate the time and consideration of this committee.
Since I've been in this legislature, I have come to have great respect for naturopathic physicians. I truly have learned more about them, and I think that's why we put the criteria on the in Senate Bill 717, starting with line 22. When conducting the required review, they must consider the barriers to access to care and the danger or harm that exists under the current scope of practice. The second thing they need to look at is significant new barriers in access to care and the danger or harm that might result. All right. Third thing, the public health, safety, and welfare benefits that would result from the proposed change to the scope of practice. And in many of the scope of practices that have come forward, it definitely, with naturopaths, has, I think, been in the best interests of the patients. Under D, it says we need to look at the most cost-effective means for accomplishing the proposed change in the scope of practice. And again, a lot of the services that naturopathic physicians provide are much cheaper, more cost-effective than in the medical community. And then the final thing that we are adding to, which I know we've had a discussion is use with the dash ones, we are adding using evidence based literature reviews on figuring out if this will be in the best interest. And I know there's not a lot of literature with naturopathic physicians, but I'm sure it's going to be up and coming. So, but that wouldn't maybe hold as much weight as the other three. Okay. Is there any other questions? All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 717. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 717.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 717.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 717. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just to clarify that.
We've added the dash ones. Is that what you did?
The yeah, dash yeah. ones. Just to clarify that while we have heard from the Center for Evidence-Based Policy of the Oregon Health Science University that they are not able to take on a convening role, they are making themselves available to assist in other ways.
Absolutely.
To assist this effort in moving forward. Just to clarify that.
Thank
for
you.
The record.
Thank you. All right, we have the is there any further discussion on the dash one amendments? Any opposition to the dash one amendment? Senator Carter? Oh, you're okay. All right, there's no opposition. Okay, clerk will call the roll on the dash one amendment.
Senator Carter?
No.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chair
Monsanderson? Aye. Amendment carries.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 717 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 717 to the floor with a due pass, as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. 717, and I've dealt with scope of practice as you have for years, and basically what's in 717 is very similar to the work groups that we would create when dealing with scope of practice. And so, you know, from that perspective, I don't think it necessarily changes anything, except it gives people a venue outside of this process to make their case. But I would also suggest that we are not tied by any of the recommendations, and we are not prevented from convening scope of practice work groups outside of this. So I view this as just an additional tool and a way to maybe inform our decisions.
I appreciate those comments because you're absolutely correct. And we are spending a lot of time with scope of practice, and it's becoming more and more complicated, and there really is a need to expand scope of practices. So if a lot of this can maybe cut down or actually improve the efficiency of the process, I am really looking forward to it happening.
But I was voting no because I thought they didn't want to be a part of this. But you're saying they're okay with this because you're not given the responsibility to them. Is that it?
Yes. The Board of Medical Examiners will not have the responsibility of making that decision. They will convene the work groups of the proponents and the opponents. There will be an application to the Board of Medical Examiners saying, I want this change of practice in my and then they will convene within 30 days a work group, and within 90 days according to the bill they will come up with a, and then they will make a recommendation to the legislature. Okay.
There's no hidden agenda here. This is a conversation Lori and Peter that got this going, and we just made a decision on ophthalmologists versus optometrists. And I'll be frank with you, I tend to be very concerned with scope of practice. But if this group, given the who we were going to put on it, had come in and recommended that you could have, in effect, there wasn't a need for that extra consultation, I would have voted on the other side of that bill. I'm just being upfront with you. Okay. I, as a veteran member of the legislature, I'm increasingly concerned, I said it, I think, several weeks ago, about the fact that I have no medical background with the exception of what's happened to me medically. I've needed a doctor to make some of these very tough decisions, and they're increasing. And all we're trying to do here is we still have the responsibility as legislators to make this decision. We haven't stepped away from that at all. But we have really tried to craft, through the leadership of the chair of this committee, a committee made up of certified smart people as well as, the whole, as well as considerations, to put us, those of us in these kind of committees, when we're faced with the kinds of groups that are coming forward and say, make this change or don't make this change, in a position, at least medically, on the facts, to make a decision. Now, politics is politics, so that's all this is. There's no hidden agenda here. There's no smoking gun, Senator Moore. This is just our work, trying to deal with the facts, so we're better prepared to make tough decisions. So, for what it's worth, I just needed to say that. I'm sorry about the natural path. I'm not so sure the natural path would have even be further ahead there right now if this group existed in terms of recommendations, to be very frank with you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other discussion, Senator Gordley?
Yes, Madam Chair. We also have this testimony, the written testimony from the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and I'm looking at the last paragraph. I think we were just handed this. The last paragraph is interesting, given our earlier discussion about the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, that what they're saying, and I quote, the Oregon Center for Evidence-Based Policy is an institution that exists to provide services such as drug review for the prescription managed drug plan. Although their work is of the highest caliber, it is unclear that their purpose and mission, as well as resources, are designed to assist in decision-making regarding regulated professional practice in the board in the broad context of scope.
Madam Chair, I fully understanding that that the center is not in the decision-making loop here in the bill. All they are is an information source.
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to vote for the bill.
All right. Is there any other discussion? Do we have a motion on the floor for the entire bill as amended?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 717 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 717, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 948, and Senator Westland should be called down because I know that he wants to testify on this bill, and we have 20 minutes. This is our last bill.
I don't think that's a bad bill at all.
And
Okay. Lynn Marie, do you want to just make a few statements while we're waiting for Wesleyan to come?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider, representing SEIU, and you have, I believe, before you now the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 948, which were drafted to do basically what I described in committee the other day. Do you, Madam Chair,
just review, since we have so many bills before us, review,
yes.
Just...
So this is the bill that creates the framework for a local health care needs assessment and planning process and a mechanism for allowing that process to inform certificate of need decisions made at the state level, as well as expanding the applicability of the certificate of need law and placing in statute a list of criteria that DHS is to follow in making those certificate of need decisions. Do you wish me to walk through the issues quickly?
What is the desire of the committee?
Yes. Okay. So what the dash two amendments do is, as you see, they replace the original bill so that we can simply walk through those. On page two, you have the first language, which basically enacts the regime to cover hospital projects. Madam Chair, shall I suspend my comments to allow the senator to speak?
Yes. Perfect.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Carter, Senator Cruz, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Gordley. Now, I want to tell you, I've had the, for the record, Senator Ben Wesleyan, District 27, I had the high honor this morning of first-time experience of being 86th from a committee hearing room by one of the members on the dais that I did not mention. It was absolutely a thrilling experience, and I appreciate it.
I wanted him in his committees where he belonged.
Good morning, Mr. President. I am here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 948, and I've been asked to answer a specific question regarding 948, and that is, does this bill conflict in any way with Senate Bill 329, the health care reform bill that Senator Bates and I will pass out of the Senate Special Committee on Health Care Reform this evening? Finally, yes, Lori, you get your wish. The short answer is no. The long answer is also no. 948 and 329 do not conflict in any way. In fact, both bills are a strong complement to one another, sending a clear message that we as Oregon legislators are no longer content, nor can we or Oregonians afford to continue the status quo as represented by the structure of today's healthcare delivery system. Does 948 solve all of Oregon's certificate of need issues? Absolutely not. Does it solve one of them? Yes, it does. And one is a far better number than zero. Am I here to bash hospitals? Far from it. They've only saved my life three times in the last 4 years, and for that I am eternally grateful. But as institutions with strong commitments and ties to their communities, it is my belief that any expansions must meet a documented community need as confirmed by a meaningful but not onerous certificate of need. Is there more that we should do with certificate of need this session? Of course. Is there more that we can do? I don't think we can this session. Is 948 a good honest and meaningful first step? Absolutely. Let's take that first step. The rest of the journey will be shorter. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question. Yes, Senator Carter.
Senator, how do you view a portion of this broader health care conversation being dealt with in this way before you can finish the piece that you have, the piece that former Governor Kitz Harbor has, and how do we start putting the pieces together unless we have a base or a conduit by which the total conversation is taking place?
Excellent question, Senator. I appreciate it very much. And that's one of the strengths of Senate Bill 329. What 329 really allows is it produces a blueprint, a roadmap, whereby we can have the conversation to comprehensively address many of the issues. And it's just not certificate of need. I mean, I say in all of my addresses on this subject, you know, you look at just some of the overwhelming issues that we face and that, you know, you note just how large this crisis is. I mean, this is a crisis of enormous economic and ethical proportion. And you go through all of the litany. This is just regrettably, unfortunately, true. I mean, we have some of the lowest health outcomes in the world, yet we have the best doctors, hospital, and access to technology. And that's compounded by the fact that we spend twice as much money as any other industrial country in the world. And when you look at that, our inclination as human beings is to blame something or somebody else.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's my thought. If we have municipalities involved, we have, in terms of this decision, we have the general public, we have the docs, we have the hospitals, we have the ambulatory centers, we have everybody. And maybe you and Dr. Bates have talked to the generalized constituency here, and you can feel comfortable about that. But I don't see where there has been a comprehensive group of partners brought to the table to have conversation around not only certificate of needs, but the other expansionary kind of things that you're thinking about in terms of OHP as well as private deliverers of services. How do you accommodate that larger group if indeed you've already established something?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, how we do that is we pass Senate Bill 329. That is the process that allows for the safe harbor conversations with all parties at the table to weave the cloth of a thousand threads. You know, there is no panacea answer to this. There is no silver bullet. One little button we can push that, aha, here it is, we solved it. No, no. We've got to weave this cloth of a thousand threads. There are many variables. There isn't one thing we can do that allows us to take a seven-league boot step down the field. There are only many little steps that must be taken. Passing a hospital-centric a certificate of need is just one of those steps. Do we need ambulatory surgery centers? Do we need imaging centers? Do we need lab certificates? Absolutely. You know, there is, you know, no one is all to blame, but we are all partially to blame. Doctors, lawyers, insurance companies, hospitals, you know, surgery centers, we as citizens, a.k.a. consumers, we also share part of the culpability in this. There is no one person to blame. We all have, you know, our fingerprints on creating this crisis. And that's why these safe harbor conversations are so vitally necessary. You know, is 948 a good first step? Absolutely. But we must take many others on certificate of need as well.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you and good morning, Senator
Wilson. Good morning.
In your testimony, you're saying to us, and I'm looking at
your third paragraph here, that while Senate Bill 329 calls on the New Oregon Health Trust Board to evaluate and make recommendations to the next legislature on the coordination of the CON program and all other health-related programs in the state. Well, that's what you're saying.
Yes.
That's a part of the work of the Oregon Health Trust Board. But is there explicit language in 329 that says that that's one of the roles of
Absolutely not.
There is.
Yes.
Explicit language. In the language...
Senator, if I could, what the bill specifically calls for is in the delivery delivery subcommittee. We have five subcommittees, one for finance, one for benefits, one for delivery system, one for eligibility, and a very strong section on federal issues. So we have five subcommittees set up. In the delivery section subcommittee, we call for a comprehensive consideration of certificate of need to specifically be addressed.
And does the language specify, give a time frame for when the issue would be taken up and determined?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, there are two specific timelines in Senate Bill 329. The first is that the Oregon Health Trust Board and the subcommittees are to report its progress back to the February 08 session, and then they are required to present to Legislative Council by October 1 of 08 their proposed recommendations to put into statutory legislation for the 09 session to consider. So I think the short answer to your question is yes.
Further discussion? At this point, we only have about 9 minutes left. We'll probably have you come back, but I want to invite Rick, is it Cajun? Caden? Kagan, Dave Anderson, and Jane Ellen Widens, and then to get your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Westland.
Mm-hmm. And if I may, Senator Carter?
Yes.
I insist that you accept the offer I made earlier this morning.
Thank you.
You didn't make any offers to me. Go back to committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Kagan. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Providence Health System in Oregon. And many of you, maybe most of you, know that we represent seven hospitals, two in Portland, one in Milwaukee, one in Newburgh, one in Hood River, a hospital in Seaside, and a hospital in Medford, seven altogether. Providence continues to oppose Senate Bill 948, as I've talked to some of you about. I think you have a letter that was distributed that articulates my major concerns with respect to 948. But just for sake of time, just three really quick points, Madam Chair and committee. The first is the bill will not reduce health care expenses, as has been suggested. As a matter of fact, it may have the reverse effect on hospital expenses, and that is increasing. The current legislation articulates a $1 million limit, anything over $1 million. Hospitals and health systems around the state purchase and build hundreds of $1 million projects per year, and that, in my estimation, would increase the cost of the infrastructure not only for the health systems, but also for the state to administer such regulation. Number two, I don't believe personally that certificate of need, as this bill articulates, will improve access to the uninsured or the insured by delaying projects, putting a significant timeline on the building of projects and the purchasing of equipment, I think access to the uninsured and the insured will be jeopardized. And finally, I have a suggestion as an alternative, and that is this, a state health plan. The Certificate of Need regulation articulates that a state health plan should be updated on a routine basis. And I think a lot of that is being done, or at least talked about, in Senate Bill 329, as Senator Westland articulated. And my recommendation is that an updated state health plan be looked at, and Certificate of Need as a part of that health plan, for the purpose of figuring out over the next year or two what the state health situation needs to be. That concludes my testimony. Happy to answer questions or turn the time to Mr. Anderson.
How does Providence make the decision to expand? Based on marketing?
Based on community need and market need, but based on mostly on community need in our markets.
And I know that you do you make money on all your hospitals?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we do not make money on all of our hospitals.
And would you say that's an advantage of having a conglomerate like you do? Because then you can cite hospitals in areas that do not have the market?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am. I believe that it's to the advantage of the state for an integrated delivery system, a large integrated delivery system like the Providence Health System, to be able to put hospitals and grow hospitals in communities where we do not make a net income to provide services to those folks in those communities.
Is that information available to know which hospitals have a profit and which don't?
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
First questions.
I do have a question. It's unrelated. Then again, it is related. And because Mr. Kagan is here, I'm going to ask again for information that I requested earlier on a previous bill. We heard testimony on related to mental health, and I can't recall the bill number, but the testimony was that mental health patients at a Providence facility or facilities are not getting enough access to fresh air. That request for information was made by me to Ms. Jane Ellen Whiteant sitting next to you, and she's working on that request, but I want to let you know that I'm still waiting for the information, and the information was requested, I'm sure it was 3 weeks ago or more. We need to know how our mental health patients are doing in your facility, and if there are issues around access to fresh air, we want to know that you know that that's a concern that's been expressed in public testimony, and we want to know that you're on top of it and that you're going to get a response back to us as quickly as possible.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, ma'am. We will get a response back as soon as possible.
I'm further concerned because it's a facility in my district. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Let's go next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm president of Anderson Construction Company, Portland, Oregon. We're a 57-year-old construction firm here in the state. I'm also here to represent Association of General Contractors, which is an 1,100-member organization with 55,000 employees represented working in the construction industry. My discussion today, I've got 4 points, and basically a very narrow target, the aftershock passage of Senate Bill 948. One, and I think you heard Mr. Kagan talk about this, is the fact that if you stop a project or delay it for a period of time, currently the market basket of construction goods is appreciating or inflating at about a 6% annual rate. So a six-month delay in project inception while you go through a process, the certificate of need process, could end up, let's take a $10 million project, could affect that 6 months, 0.5% a month. We could be looking at $300,000 more for that $10 million project, $300,000 more. We work a lot with hospitals. We know how hard it is to find the money to begin with, so if there's another $300,000 they'd have to find to do this. if this bill actually, and I'm not sure, I haven't read all the amendments, just the bill itself, but if the projects required to stop that are currently in progress to go through a certificate of need process, then that number significantly increases, because not only do we have the inflation that we're going to face, but we have what we call the demobilization and the remobilization costs. Contractors can't sit and do nothing. Time is money in construction business. So when we tell a contractor, if the owners, for example, if a Providence hospital gave us a stop work notice because passage of the bill, we'd have to pass that on to all our subcontractors. Because we have an indeterminate date when this is going to start back up, generally we'd have to demob the site. Eventually, one day we'd bring that all those contractors back, or we'd have to rebid it again. So not only would we face inflation, but the demob, remob costs, which our experience has been that kind of a thing, usually ends up being more in the range of 15% to 20%. So all of a sudden you're experiencing big time money now. So let's say we were halfway through that $10 million job, $5 million to go when we got the stop work notice. To crank that job back up, we'd be looking at $750,000 to a $1 million plus to get that going. My third point is another aftershock of this whole thing is that all of a sudden I put a lot of people on the unemployment roll. AGC does not represent every contractor in this Oregon industry, but represents 55,000 employees of those contractors. Not everybody's doing health care, but a lot are. Anderson itself, we have about close to 1,000 people with our own forces and our subcontractor forces involved in health care right now. Let's say, and we're a small fraction of that, I'd say, let's say we represent 20% of the entire market. So times that by four or five more, and that's kind of the impact potential that this would have. So a lot of people all of a sudden show up on the unemployment roll. And on the fourth point, and then I'll close, is that we're concerned already as an industry about finding workers. Construction workers are hard to come by. There's a lot of industries calling for workers. And we have a lot of people now in schools, high schools and such, that are looking at other trades. We are earnestly pursuing, and you've probably heard workforce bills and such like that, pursuing workers to come to our industry. If all of a sudden we don't have a place for these people to go, a significant number of them for a long time, when these projects do finally start up, when the rules have been written and projects are now got received certificate of needs and they can start again, that rush to the market is going to be significant. The costs, of course, we already talked about inflation and such like that. But the fact is we may not be able to staff it. And, of course, it's all the supply and demand world out there. And when you can't staff projects, then all of a sudden money start going up because, okay, I'll take your project over that project because I can make a better fee on it. This, you know, I heard Mr. Kagan say this is not going to reduce costs. Certainly it will not from the construction standpoint. It'll be a significant increase in costs. Thank you. Happy the opportunity to speak before you today. Any questions you might have, I'd be happy to answer.
Appreciate your comments, Mr. Anderson, and thanks for coming. On the dash, which are we working on? The dash twos on page 17, section 16, it does say that the amendments of this act do not apply to any construction projects for which all necessary permits are obtained before the 2007 act. So that would waylay some of your concern. Thank you.
Chairwoman Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Jane Ellen Whitehouse, Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. You've heard me talk about this bill before, so I'll try to be as brief as I know how. We are still opposed to this bill, even with the dash two amendments, and we have three basic reasons why we're opposed to it. After 40 years, CON has not proven to be effective in controlling costs. As Mr. Kagan said, it actually has raised costs in many areas. You have some research in front of you that shows that many very reputable places, including Duke University, the American Medical Association, and others have proven and have done research that has shown that CON actually raises costs. And if you compare us just to Missouri, 2 years ago when CON, the Certificate of Need Bill, came up, we did some research that compared us to Missouri, which was the model that people were looking at the time. And if you adopted that model, which this bill is very similar to, you would raise cost $500 per year for every Oregonian, or $1.7 billion per year in health care costs. And I told you before that I think that by only focusing on one aspect of the healthcare delivery system that you have a problem, that you fragment it. And as I was driving today, what it reminded me of is a balloon. And when you push on a balloon on one side, and if the healthcare delivery system is your entire balloon and you push on the balloon, the rest of it pops out through your other fingers. And the only way to really get your whole hand around a balloon is to have a system or something big enough to get it around. If you just do certificate of need on hospitals, you will continue the drive towards more ambulatory surgical centers and imaging centers. We've gone from 10 ambulatory surgical centers in 1993 to 75 today. That's a huge increase, and part of the reason why, not the only reason, but part of the reason why, is that there is not a certificate of need program for those facilities. Oregon's hospitals, on the other hand, have actually declined in the same time period. We don't have more beds. We don't license and or staff additional beds. We have maintained a fairly stagnant system because of the pressures that are on the healthcare delivery system, both the market and the financing and regulatory aspects of it. So, again, if you just focus on one segment of this, you're going to continue to burst that balloon out in another aspect. Senator Westland talked about Senate Bill 329 and weaving the threads that he was talking about, and I agree with him that there are 1,000 threads. I've read every single dash amendments to 329, and to answer Senator Gordley's question, there is specific language in there that directs the committees to look at effective, how effective certificate of need is on controlling costs and access and providing ensuring access, and then coming back with a recommendation to the legislature in the next session. So there is language there, and we think that that's the appropriate place for this discussion to happen. As you're looking at all the aspects, you're looking at the entire balloon from the inside and the outside of that balloon. If you just pull one single thread out, you've caused an additional wrinkle that makes it harder to then to get to the end goal that where we want access, cost control, transparency, and quality. So thank you for allowing me to testify before you again today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? All right. Thank you. We have requested a fiscal on this. We don't, when it states at the very beginning, the Department of Human Services shall adopt rules, designate health care planning areas, establish guidelines for local planning. And so I'm not sure, I'm looking at Dr. Higginson, if there is a fiscal, my staff is saying it should be minimal. But I need to get that. So if we can request that fiscal with the dash, I always forget, twos, and that we will carry this over until April 30th, and we need to know the cost and what we should do with this bill. All right. All right, with that, no further discussion.
Okay.
Close public hearing on 948, and we're adjourned. Oh, we will meet on Monday, and hopefully we can get all our business done Monday morning. If not, we are scheduled for what time?
I haven't gotten the system right yet,
okay.
So we don't know.
We may be meeting about 5, but hopefully we can get everything done Monday. All right, we're adjourned.
Are you available Monday evening?
Mm-hmm, I can.